You are at the intersection of wealth, health, and happiness. Welcome to the Wealthy, Wealthy Life. Hi, I'm Christina Wise, and welcome to Wealthy, Wealthy Life. This is where I interview thought leaders who teach a countercultural approach to money, health, and happiness, because a good life is a wealthy, wealthy life. Today, I interview Srini Pillai. He is the founder and CEO of Neuro Business Group, which is a cutting edge and innovative company dedicated to enhancing human possibility and potential, as well as teaching people how to lead happier and more productive lives based on the most recent research from psychology and brain science. Clearly, he's a happiness hacker. He's a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, in other words, an MD, top at every single class he's ever been to. He's a certified master coach in psychology. He's a brain imaging specialist, and he's the award-winning author of Life Unblocked, Seven Revolutionary Lessons to Overcome Fear, as well as Your Brain and Business, The Neuroscience of Great Leaders, and The Science Behind the Law of Attraction. He's amazing. He's been voted top 20 mover and shaker in leadership development in the world in 2013. He's been featured on many mainstream media outlets like Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Entrepreneur Magazine, CNN, Fox, Oprah Radio, Martha Stewart, Whole Living, NPR, on and on and on. Like, his list of credentials is like three pages. So today we talk about activating your inner genius, honing a possibility mindset, how to self-talk can change your brain, how self-talk can change your brain. That's pretty amazing. And we talk about his unique circa technique for calming down the amygdala to help manage stress and anxiety. I have no doubt you're going to get so many golden nuggets out of this conversation. So enjoy. Srini, it is so fun to be here with you today. It's great to be with you in a mastermind group. And, you know, I'm so lucky because I get to access to your brain all the time. But I'd love to expose your genius to my audience and everyone listening today. So thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. And, you know, when I was thinking about sort of how I wanted to show up today, really what I wanted to do was to be able to contribute to a conversation so that I could activate the genius in others. Because I think for so long, you know, part of the discomfort of being in this role where you understand the science of the brain or you understand the science of success is that people look to you for answers. And although I'm going to be explaining a lot of different things and a lot of different mechanisms, I think the first point I'd want to make is that the real genius, the real answers reside within yourself.
Well, that's brilliant, and there's not a better way to begin. So yeah, I think that's the whole purpose of the work that we do, is we do our own exploration and we share what we learn or what we know or what we believe to be true and offer it to others so they can tap into the inner genius and do something with that information. So you are quite impressive. I love the story that you tell, that where you just called Harvard and said, hey, you're in South Africa, and you just called Harvard and say, I want to go to school there. Can I talk to the head dude of Harvard? And it worked. So do you mind? It's such a great story. Do you mind sharing that story quickly?
Sure. You know, I was literally just, you know, it was after medical school. I decided I wanted to do a year of research or residency. And I thought, where would I want to do this in the world? And having traveled some before that, I thought, you know, I'd heard of Harvard. Someone in my final exam mentioned Harvard in association with me. And I thought, well, why don't I call up and see how to get in? And at that time, I was naive enough that I didn't realize how ridiculous that was. So, you know, I ended up calling this main number at the school, and they referred me from there to the medical school. And, you know, everybody who picked up was like, what? And then they were like, oh, sure, yeah, you can speak to the head of whoever. And eventually I got through to the head of the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard. And I subsequently trained at this very hospital. And when you trained at the hospital, you couldn't get an appointment with him for like a month. So on that day that I called, his secretary was away from her desk. He was walking by. He doesn't usually pick up the phone. He picked up the phone. And I said, hi, you know, my name is Srini Pillai. I'm sitting here in South Africa. I just done a fellowship in brain chemistry. And I said, I was just thinking, boy, wouldn't it be great to be at Harvard? And he laughed with me later. And he was like, and I was thinking, yeah, like, you know, you and everybody else think that. But you know, he was very decent about it. He said, why don't you send me a page of why you'd like to be here? Send me your resume, your CV, and we'll see where it goes. And so I did, and he circulated it. And a couple of weeks later, I actually got a call from someone who was just amazing, the father of psychopharmacology, Jonathan Cole, who called me and did, you know, asked me if, I mean, we had a few exchanges, and then he said, you know, I'd like to interview you, and interviewed me on the phone. And a couple of weeks later, I got a FedEx saying, welcome to Harvard. And it really was sort of an amazing example to me of humbly approaching what you want without any expectation, but with the excitement that it would be really awesome to get there. And I think had I not gone there, I would have done something else that excited me as well. But at the time, just the ability to call and to explore what I wanted to do is something that, you know, really it set the stage for the rest of my life in a particular way, even though I think up until that point I was building up to it. And since then, I've really wanted to share that message with people, to sort of ask them, is there something that you want to do that you haven't tried because you think it's ridiculous? Because the truth is, even though our brains are wonderful in guiding us in different places, sometimes they over-guide and over-protect. Because now if someone came to me and said, how do I get into Harvard? I'm on the faculty of Harvard now. I wouldn't say, well, just call Harvard. But that's absurd, right? Because if I had asked someone, they would have said, don't be ridiculous. You can't just call Harvard.
Well, and you even said that in your interview, because your family came back and said, well, why didn't you tell us? And you're like, because you would have told me that that would be impossible. So I thought there was a lesson in that as well.
Absolutely. You know, I always say to people, I think the number one thing when it comes to any goal that you have in life is to have a possibility mindset. And the possibility mindset is simply stating your goal. You don't have to be all chipper about it. You don't have to have sort of the affect of positive thinking. You just have to say, listen, this is what I want. This is what I want to get. And in order to get that, I'm going to go through the steps I need to go through to get there. Because the simple truth is that if your brain doesn't know what you want, it's not going to rally and set up conscious and unconscious processes to get you to your goal.
So you are an MD, and I love your background because it's really all over the place, but in a good way, meaning I can tell you have a curious mind. You're always learning. You're always a master of your own self. But I love the broad spectrum of your expertise, because it looks like even with it's an MD, it's psychology, psychiatry. And, you know, I think when we normally think of psychiatry, what comes to mind for most is mental illness, is the pathology, the what's wrong. But it sounds like maybe, and I'm curious if this is true or not, but then that's one way of looking at the brain, or looking at you just diagnose, you know, the diagnostic of what could possibly be wrong, versus it looks like you've even expanded that to more even the positive psychology side of things and looking at it, you know, how can we work less maybe about pathology and look more about the positive sides of self-actualization and moving ourselves towards those goals and more of the positive side. But then you've even taken it a step further, it looks like, where I love your work with neuroscience. It's like, this is all great, but how does the brain work? We're learning so much more about the brain, and there's so much new science, and it looks like you're into brain imaging. And so I'm very curious, you and I have never really had these conversations, of the neuroscience and what's new with the neuroscience that you've now discovered and others in your field have discovered. And based on that, what is it like, how can we apply this new knowledge in our lives in a way, because now we know the brain's working to cause us maybe to be stuck in sort of these psychological patterns, if you will.
Yeah. So a couple of parts to your question. I think the first part is sort of the diversity of my background in, you know, being an MD, having studied the brain for 17 years in a lab, then branching out into executive coaching and then working with people in executive coaching. I think all of that, and directing the anxiety service at McLean Hospital at Harvard, I think all of those things really made me aware that being human is an incredible gift, and that as much as we have a lot of challenges come our way, the reality is that along with those challenges come opportunities for learning. And I think we can discover our strengths along the way as well. So my feeling has been, you know, acknowledge the challenges, acknowledge the weaknesses, feel sad when you're sad, feel angry when you're angry, but why not spend a considerable amount of life taking your brain's attentional flashlight and putting it on the positive and on the strengths, because what you feed will grow. So I think one of the things that I think we've learned over time, and this is not a brand new finding, but the brain can change and you can change your brain. And to me, what's really exciting is that there are a number of studies that now show that when you have the intention to change your brain, you can actually reach in and do something. Now, initially, people will say, really? Can I really do that? And I'll say, well, you know, what happens if I ask you to lift up your hand? You lift up your hand. Like, how do you think that happens? You give an instruction to your brain to lift your hand up. You know, if I ask you to turn your head around, you do that. So if I ask you to get rich, why wouldn't you be able to do that? And it's like, well, because I know how to lift up my hand and I know how to turn my head. But how to get rich, like, I don't know. You know, a lot of people don't know. The truth is, once you give your brain that instruction, it's both conscious and unconscious processes that work together to help you get to your goal. But that instruction is necessary. So in relation to your question, I think one powerful thing that people may not know is that self-talk, just the way you speak to yourself, can actually change your brain. And we know, you know, so here's one nugget, I think, which I found really exciting, which is that when you talk to yourself, if you talk to yourself in the second person, you're much more likely to decrease your stress and allow yourself to go on than if you talk to yourself in any other voice. So, you know, you see this a lot with like tennis players, right? They're walking back to the baseline and they're saying, you know, come on, like, you know, and the reality is that if you say, if I were talking to myself and I said, I can do it, it's not as effective as saying, Srini, you can do it. So if you say your name and you talk to yourself as if you're another person, you're much more likely to decrease your stress. So knowing stuff like that, I think, is so important, because the one thing we do know is that we can communicate with ourselves. And a lot of times we're at odds with the world because we don't know where to look for help. And that's part of the reason I started out by saying you can feel empowered scientifically, because the reality is you can talk to yourself and change your brain. So I think at the forefront of this whole movement is the understanding that you can change your brain. And the one caveat I'd want to say is that, you know, a lot of people are like, really, can this really be for everybody? No, not the same principle doesn't necessarily work for everybody. But if you take these principles and use them as a scaffolding, you'll be surprised at how in your own self-exploration, they'll direct you in a much more effective way toward your goals. So, you know, if there was a particular area you were interested in, I'd be happy to highlight that. But I could talk about this topic forever, because I think the brain is just such a beautiful, you know, organ.
And well, I think you're tapping into that. Really is what the latest neuroscience, and you're right, it's been around for a while, but it's becoming more mainstream knowledge. I mean, that before, because traditionally the belief was you couldn't change your brain. After a certain age, you're kind of locked in, and that's the best that you got, and you had to deal with it. But now what which the neuroscience field believes to be true, is like, that's absolutely false. The neuroplasticity, we can be changing our brain all the time, regardless of a lot of the history, by, like you said, maybe starting with the intention. But, you know, intention is one of those words that I think can be fairly loose. Like, what is an intention really? Like, I set an intention. Is this woo-woo? Is it real? What is it? How is that different from a goal, maybe? You know, a lot of this, you know, we throw out words like intention, but I really like what you said here, and I'm wondering if this is your distinction for intention. And you said it's what you're telling your brain you want. Is that kind of an easy way to think about it? Like, I want this. It's a signal to your brain or communication to your brain. Is that a way to think about it?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there are two kinds of intentions that the brain works with generally. One is called a goal intention, which is something like, I want to be rich. And then you have an implementation intention, which is a much more well sort of oriented and dissected intention. It's like, it's not just saying, I want to get rich. It's saying, I want to make $100,000 in the next 6 months by doing X, Y, or Z. And I will set aside 3 hours a day toward that goal. When you give your brain a more specific goal, an implementation intention, it actually is more likely to lead to success. In fact, a lot of the research around this has been shown in the weight loss realm. So people who are much more specific about their weight goals are much more likely to be successful at it than if they're just general and say, I want to go to the gym or I want to look great. So the brain is sensitive to how you word your intentions. And I think intentions are a direction or a signal to your brain to start working and to start rallying to get you to your goal.
Yeah, and then I have read some stuff with about the brain. I'm curious if you believe this to be true, but the way the brain works is that it really does need to be actionable. Like the brain, we want to set the intention or goal far enough away so it really drives us or pulls us, and that it's almost on the edge of is it possible or impossible. But if it's too loose or too impossible, like our brain already knows, like that's entertainment. That's, you know, so it just discounts it all the way. So then we can get very disillusioned. Like I set all these big goals or intentions or dreams and nothing happens. Well, because it's not defined enough and it's just on the other side of what's actually possible. And, you know, our brains are, you know, are pretty smart that it can kind of like know that that's, don't even go there because that's not a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, there are studies that show us. So I'll give you a concrete example. If you ask someone to sit in a brain imaging scanner, so you imagine them lying down and looking up and their brains are being imaged, and you ask them to imagine rotating their hand 15 degrees. So not actually moving the hand, but just imagine rotating your hand 15 degrees. Your brain will start to activate so that it looks like you are imagining rotating your hand 15 degrees. If you say, imagine rotating your hand 360 degrees, because it's actually impossible to do that, your brain doesn't even start the process. It just says, you know, ridiculous, I'm not going to do that. So I think to your point, if the goal that you're articulating sounds so outrageous, it actually gets your brain all sort of stuck. Now, having said that, technically, the goal of going to Harvard is outrageous, especially if you just don't know anybody and you're calling somebody. But at that time, I actually naively believed that it was possible. I actually didn't know the degrees of resistance that it involved. I didn't know. So in that instance, that's the way I would explain that. I would say that, you know, my brain thought it's perfectly normal to pick up the phone and call someone and say, hey, you know, you have a school, I'd like to go there. What does it take to get there? My brain wasn't filled with all this obstructive stuff. So I think the first point I would make is that set a goal that you feel is believable, no matter what that is. And then to my initial point, when it's believable, chunk it down so that you can actually, your brain can know what the different steps are. And then the third point I'd want to make, which I think is sort of an interesting finesse point, is that the goal itself is motivating, and that's called extrinsic motivation. But one of the most important things to remember is that intrinsic motivation is really important as well. In fact, you know, one of my favorite papers right now is a paper by a philosopher who also works in neuroscience, Bryce Huebner. And he's challenged this view that goals are by themselves motivating. Now, I think most people would understand and agree that even intuitively, goals are motivating. Because when you see something in front of you and you know you can get there, it feels great. But what he suggests is that in our brains, there are neural circuits that represent the different aspects of who we are. Like it may be the you who succeeded when you were in fifth grade, the you who brought home a report that you were ashamed of, the you who lost the love of your life, the you who succeeded by getting a promotion in your job. Each of these different circuits actually represents a certain kind of motivational power in your brain. And one of the things he suggests is that we have a lot of research to support the fact that when you have a critical number of self-related circuits in your brain that are motivating, you can feel motivated to get to your goal. But if you only have the negative circuits activated, then that's who you are. And so you don't feel motivated because you're not operating from the core of your own strengths. So one of the things I would say is that it's important to pay attention to external goals and to allow them to draw you or drive you, but it's equally important to pay attention to your current self-concept. You know, for example, when we want to go after our goals, a lot of the time we feel desperate, right? But desperation suggests the secondary message is you can't get it. And the whole idea is, how do you go from desperation to inspiration? How do you say, you know, and to me, the possibility mindset is all about saying, if one person in the world can do this, then it's doable. And so I just need to figure out my way to get to that goal. And so when it comes to financial goals, I think you know, is there anyone in the world who's made $100,000 in 6 months? Sure. Is anyone who's made $1 million in 6 months? Sure. Is anyone who's made $1 billion in 6 months? Sure. So now we know that that possibility is the scenario, the brain scenario that we're setting up. That doesn't mean you're going to know how to do it. It doesn't even mean you're going to consciously know how to do it. But what it does mean is that you are setting the agenda for your brain. You're saying, hey, brain, I know you were there before. We're changing the story. We're going on. This is my new goal. This is my new goal that's believable. Here are the final points of how we get there. I am motivated by the goal, but the new me is the new me that has activated all these new me circuits. And by activating those circuits, I'm going to motivate myself to get to my goal. And, you know, we're human. Like, we all have bad days. So it's not like those all the good circuits, the positive circuits are on every day. You know, sometimes you get into a funk and get stuck in a rut and you don't really know how to get to the next place. That's fine. The beauty of the brain is that you can reset it. So you take a break, take a time out, reset your brain and get your circuits back online so that you can get to your goal.
It's like when you do a reset on your computer or...
Right.
Absolutely. So you said a couple things there that really stood out to me. And it's really, I don't remember exactly how you phrased it, but it's the idea of that we can choose the new me, like today's the new me. So I can really let go of all that other stuff. It doesn't matter up until right this moment, I can declare the new me. And with this new declaration, I'm setting these new intentions, these goals, extrinsically, intrinsically. But it's like, it sounds like it starts with this declaration, assuming we want to move from the spot of desperation to inspiration of today's the day, new me.
Right.
I can let all that other stuff drop off the back of the bus. And not, and to your point, we're not going to have bad days or self-doubt that's going to drop in there or whatever. But it starts with this belief that I can be new, I can reset, I can start over.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the things I'd want to point out is that stress and anxiety actually activate habit pathways in the brain. So when you're stressed out, the first thing your brain does is it goes back to old ways of thinking and old ways of believing. And so the first thing to remember is to think about how, you know, what works for you in terms of de-stressing. And there are a lot of different things we could talk about that. But there are ways in which you can actually connect with your brain to help de-stress it. And then in that de-stress moment, and again, you don't have to be de-stressed the whole day. And there are times when stress actually helps. That's called eustress. And, you know, it's the kind of stuff that gets you going, gets you to finish tasks. And then there's distress, which is when stress stops actually helping you. And distress is what you actually want to take away from your life. So even if now you think, if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, yeah, right, like, how am I going to get rid of my distress? You know, I have to, you know, I'm a boss, I'm a soccer mom, I'm a sister, I'm a best friend. And the whole day I've got to attend to everyone's needs besides my own. The first thing I would say is, all of that stuff is you're going to stay stuck in the old pattern if you don't carve out some time, even a half hour in your day. And you can even start with a half hour in your week just to do what de-stresses you. And so I really would want to emphasize that it's important to de-stress so that you don't fall into these old habits. And that when you're setting your goal, you can activate this new you. And also, I think a lot of people feel freaked out by that because they feel like, you know, I feel like I'm faking it. Like, you know, is this really me? Like, am I being falsely enthusiastic? I would say, you know, you have the right to explore yourself. You have the right to go in there and say, yeah, maybe I'm faking it. Like, so what? I still want to figure out what it is that makes me happy. And I think just that curiosity itself, that self-exploration, giving yourself the time to say, you know, how can I find myself is actually it's an abstract question. But believe me, it's the greatest gift you can give to yourself in the day, because I can't tell you how many people I know who do not take out any time in their day for themselves. I'll give you a concrete example. A colleague of mine was telling me recently, she's actually an internist. She said she was speaking to a very busy mother who had a million things to do, who called in saying she had chest pain. And when she said, she took the history and she said, I think you're having a heart attack. You'd better come in. And she said, but I can't come in today. My son's got a game. My husband's coming back from a long trip. And she said, wait a minute. Like, I'm not even sure what you're talking about. Like, what are you saying? I'm telling you, you're having a heart attack. And she said, it's going to have to wait till tomorrow. Now, that's an extreme example, but I think a lot of people don't realize that they're putting aside vital things about themselves for some nebulous day that will never come. And in the process, they're not doing themselves or anyone else any good. Because in that case, if that woman had died on that day, you know, it's not like her husband and son would have been really thankful for that. So it's just a reminder to ask yourself, have I put aside even half a day in a month for myself? And what can I do? And you don't have to do it, you know, impertinently or selfishly. It can just be, it is what we all feel, right? Everybody wants to do something that feels like they're taking care of themselves. So why not do it in the spirit of that?
And you're saying, number one, it's just nice self-care. But beyond that, it's really, it's scientific. It's operational with the brain that we cannot reset in a stressful environment, in a stressful state. So if we do really want to change, we're going to have to produce a de-stress environment, or, you know, where we can see things differently, because it's impossible to make decisions or be more proactive or look at things a different way when you're constantly in this moment, this stressful feeling in the body and lots of noise and things coming at you. It's only produces the ability to be in this reactive state. So you can't be in this reactive state and be setting intentions and reset and where do I want to go at the same time.
Yeah, I think one way to remember that, I always tell people, stress is the key to habit hell. If you want the key to habit hell, then stay in stress.
Stress is the key to habit hell.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that. So you've been mentioning the word stress quite a bit, and stress is a phenomena of our times. And, you know, for the most part, all of us are stressed at some level, right? And more or less on the eustress side, and I'd say more on the distress. And I think that's the goal. A lot of my listeners, they're high performers. So they are achievers. They are performers, but they do come to me. A lot of them, they're making money. They have a family, a good family. I mean, life overall appears like it should be really good, but there's still something missing. Like and they can't quite get to the bottom of what's missing. I'm in this stressful state. I'm just always going from thing to thing, meeting to meeting, email to email. And I just feel like, you say, Christina, that meditation is this incredible practice, but like, are you kidding me? Like, when am I ever going to be able to fit 15, 20 minutes into my day ever? Like, that is one of those impossible things and intentions or goals. So what do you say to that? Like, what is stress? How does it affect the brain? And is it possible to get out of some of these patterns? As in this crazy digital life and an age where we all find ourselves, when we were talking before the show started, in fact, that things are changing so fast and, you know, new technology, new this, new that, and our brain likes novelty. And I mean, it's just noise and, you know, things coming at us all the time.
Yeah, there are a lot of different things that I think we can pay attention to when it comes to stress. So stress in general, I think, has so many different definitions that people are generally confused about it. But the one general thing is that stress can activate hormones in your body that are in the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And when it does that, it can activate a whole series of reactions in your body. So let's just look at one of those reactions. So let's look at the anxiety part of stress. So if you are anxious, and remember, this can be conscious or unconscious. Like, a lot of people will say to me, you know, I'm cool, like, I'm calm, I'm not anxious. It's like, well, sure. So consciously, you're not anxious. The question is, are you unconsciously anxious? And we can talk about that a little bit later. But anxiety activates the anxiety center in the brain, which is called the amygdala. And when it causes these earthquakes in the amygdala, you get these aftershocks in the thinking brain, which is the frontal cortex, because the anxiety brain and the thinking brain are actually connected. Now, the amygdala does much more than just process anxiety, but it is one key center where anxiety is processed. So when you get this amygdala that's shaken up and it's directly connected to your thinking brain, which is also shaking, it's really hard to think because your thinking becomes skewed because it's basically rattling from the after effect of the anxiety that's affecting your amygdala. So one of the things we have to ask is, how can we calm down the amygdala and stabilize the thinking brain? And one of the paradigms that I've been teaching for a while is a paradigm defined by the mnemonic circa. And circa is each letter stands for a different thing. So the C in circa is for chunking it down. The I is for ignoring mental chatter. The R is for reality check. The C is for control check. And the last A is for attention shift. So let me explain what I mean by that. So in general, when you have a fear or an anxiety, it presents itself initially in its hugest form, right? I have an IRS tax audit. It's like, what? It's like, oh my God, I'm going to have to go through every line of every expense. And it's so overwhelming. So but if you said, okay, there's a beginning to this and there's an end to this. The end is going to be a resolution one way or another. Don't know what it is. The beginning is going to be, first, let's figure out what the question is. Then let's figure out what paperwork we need. Then let's figure out how we're going to go through it. And that's what chunking it down is about. The I part is ignoring mental chatter, which relates to this mindfulness or meditation that you were talking about. And a lot of times, the moment you get the stress, you're actually just, you have your mind is just exploding with a million thoughts. And so one of the things you want to do is to calm the mind down or ignore this mental chatter. And so mindfulness is a great exercise where you get to focus your attention, you take your brain's attentional flashlight, and you place it on your breath. And when you place it on your breath, whatever this thing is, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the future? You could lose your house. What if you lose all your money? What if you never make it to your goals? You just ignore all of that and you pay attention to your breath. Now, a lot of people say to me, come on, like, you know, that sounds ridiculous. Like, does this actually work? It actually works because mindfulness decreases activation of the amygdala, and it also brings on your unfocused circuits, which allow for connections across your brain so you can find creative solutions that you may never have thought of. Wait a minute, I have an expense, but then I have this expensive item at home I'm not even really using. Maybe if I sold that, I can then, all of a sudden, opportunities present themselves in that mindful state. And that's what ignoring mental chatter is about. The reality check is what I call, it's what I summarize by saying, this too shall pass. Like when you get that bad news and someone's saying to you, oh my God, you know, you're never going to get this promotion, or, you know, I've been trying to think about how I'm going to meet my expenses now that I've got a new college bill to pay. How do I deal with this? It's this too shall pass. Whatever that stress is, it is going to pass. And just reminding your brain of that puts it in a frame where it's less anxious. Control check is about reminding yourself that in life, there are things that you are better able to control than others. So a lot of times we don't realize this, but we imagine that we are not only in charge of our finances, we are in charge of college fees, we are in charge of the stock market, we are in charge of what's going on in China, we are in charge of the presidential elections, we are in charge of everything that we see in the news. And the reality is that we're not. Like, we're much more in charge of the things in our lives. So why don't we, or, you know, like a lot of times people, like couples will try to control each other. A lot of times you'll find one person is the person who spends and the other person doesn't. So you say, listen, you've got to stop spending, or you can't buy that new toy. And it's like, well, there's some sense to that. But at a certain point in a relationship, you actually realize there are things you cannot control. So just, you know, being stuck in controlling things that you can't control is really harmful to your brain. And by just decreasing that, it deactivates the conflict center in the brain and calms down the anxiety center, which is the amygdala. So there I would say, identify one thing today that you think you're in control of that you're not, and let it go. Just one thing. And then when it comes to the last A, which is attentional shift, it's what I was saying about the brain's flashlight. You take that flashlight and you place it on the solution rather than the problem. Because a lot of times when you get this challenge that's coming your way and it's freaking you out, all you can think about is the problem. Your mind starts ruminating. Oh my God, I can't believe my daughter did this. Oh my God, this guy is like this. Oh my God, my girlfriend did this. It sort of goes on and on and on. But the reality is that if you say, okay, I'm going to spend 15 minutes today, I'm taking my brain's attentional flashlight and I'm going to say, what is the solution? Have other people solved a problem like this? And if so, what have they done? And how can I start to generate ideas for myself? And just doing those five things, this, you know, it sounds pretty casual, but each of those things has a lot of research backing it up, including mindfulness. I would say mindfulness, the ignoring mental chatter piece, probably has the most research backing it up. It can even cause genetic changes and change the way in which you intrinsically function when it comes to stress. So I always say to people, try Circa. If you can't do all of them, choose one or two of them to start. And the basis of a lot of these interventions have to do with what we call reappraisal or reframing and refocusing. And that's because whatever life gives you in a certain package, but it doesn't mean that that's exactly what it means. You can take it apart. You know, you can, I always tell people life, everything in life is like a Lego game. You just, whatever it is, you can take it apart, rearrange it, make something else from it. And so I think if we remember that and remember to take that flashlight and put it on the solution, you are actually not just doing things that, you know, a lot of people have talked about for a long time. You're actually changing your brain. And studies have shown that when you put these into practice, your brain, the stresses may not change, but the way you respond to the stresses is completely different.
Right. And the brain, it is understanding, though, that when we find ourselves in a stressful state, and if it's recurrent or happening all the time, it's triggering hormones like cortisol and the different, how it all breaks down, that then affects the body a certain way. And I mean, so it has this domino effect that overall can become very unhealthy, let alone just these fears or concerns or emotions we kind of feel through our brain.
Absolutely. In fact, I think more than ever, we now understand that the brain doesn't work in isolation, right? When you have this sympathetic overdrive, this fight or flight response, you know, causes your heart to beat faster. So obviously, something in this freak out is connecting your brain and your heart. We now know things like changes in your gut bacteria can cause mood changes. You can become depressed or anxious because of changes in your gut bacteria. So what you eat actually matters. The whole body is connected. I mean, remember, everything started from a sperm and an ovum coming together and uniting and then differentiating. But initially, everything was one. And so even though the brain is in a different part of your body and the gut is in a different part of your body, these things happen through migration of cells that just divided and formed these different organs. They were originally one. So I think, you know, not only should you be thinking about the mind-body connection, and the fact that the different aspects of you, your biological self, your psychological self, and your social self are all connected, but your body itself, you should consider completely. You know, it's like when you're training, if you don't train your core, there's nothing else you can really train that well. And so everything is dependent on everything else. And so I would encourage people, even though I'm talking about the brain, to think about their bodies in its entirety.
Right. Well, we're approaching the end of our time, and we've barely scratched the surface, of course. But there's a couple things that I'd like to ask before we complete. Number one is, you've used both these words, stress and anxiety, and my own way I differentiate them, even if they are, if you can differentiate them, is stress. The way I think about stress is tension, stress, overwhelm. When I feel stressed, I do feel like that sense of overwhelm. Too much is going on. I don't really have control. And it's just this stressful state. As opposed to anxiety, the way I relate to anxiety is when there's like real fear, like that I can't get control of. It's pending. And it's a true emotional state where, that does sort of have this psychological impact as opposed, or feels like emotional psychological anxiety. So is there a difference between the two? Do they affect the brain differently
Yeah, I think it's sort of more an academic issue right now. I think is there a difference? Yes. I think people would generally talk about stress, talk about it in a more generalized way, in the way that you were indicating. And anxiety is a more specific emotion that's a response to a fearful stimulus. So stress is not necessarily only about fear or response to fear. It could be response to disgust, a response to a whole host of things. So I'd say in general, I don't think it's worth that much thinking about the distinction, but I think if you want to separate it out for yourself, think about anxiety in response to conscious or unconscious fear, and think about stress as a generalized response to something that just feels overwhelmed.
So stress really, there's a lot of things underneath the stress category, anxiety be one, because ultimately I'm guessing is what you're saying, because the stress state and what happens to the brain, that's what happens. And, you know, it might be any one of these things that might be underneath this generalized stress label that we give it.
In fact, the reason I didn't want to initially get into stress is I realized that commonly we think, for example, that stress increases cortisol. But there are people who are so stressed that they can't even mount a cortisol response. And so, you know, it really does depend on the degree of stress that you have and where you are in your response cycle and in your resilience. So I think thinking of stress in the way you described it as having a number of different components under it is a good way to think about it.
All right. Well, maybe one final question really is the specific anxiety. So I know a lot of people that even high performers, it doesn't matter. People, it's this word anxiety. There's a lot it is this emotional stimulus. It's scary. People get stuck there. And it's not a fun way to live if you kind of are always stuck in that panic anxiety state. And you've done a lot of study with anxiety, right? And panic disorder, some of these other more pathological side of the stress. Do you have any tips for people? And the reason why I'm very interested in this and like to talk about it is my own life situation, high performer my entire life, just overachiever. And, you know, I was completely breaking down my body in the process, but I didn't even know there was a lot of stress. It just became a lifestyle until in 2013, I totally broke. And I broke because my body broke. I nearly died from heavy metal poisoning and my organs were shutting down. And so physically I was dying. But I also, because when my body broke, because my resilience broke and my strength, my physical strength and things broke, what happened is I had a mental break at the same time. And I call it, you know, I don't even like the word mental illness. I think there is mental illness and, you know, that is something to be addressed. But there's mental breaks, what I call mental fractures. And they're very scary. And when that anxiety owns you and you think you'll never get out of it, it's a horrible place and a horrible way to live. And I mean, the good news is I was able to get my physical body back and I was able to, you know, sort of fix my mind too. But our minds can break, right? Like there's this breaking point that is nothing to be ashamed of, but some of the stress side of things, if we're not able to observe it and it just goes on forever and we just deplete ourselves and find ourselves in a state of decision fatigue or whatever physiologically, the brain can break. So can you just talk about that for a second and then what we can maybe do to help fix it? If that's, I mean, I know it's possible. I've fixed mine, yeah. But what do you say from your side of the equation?
I think the first thought that evokes, and thank you for sharing your story about that, is I'm not sure if I mentioned that I'm a musician and I also do digital art. And I'm putting together a digital art collection right now, with Roberto Alberghetti, who's an artist in just outside of Milan. And the title of this collection is Cracked But Not Broken, The Art of Human Vulnerability. And the whole idea is that every human being goes through this life with multiple cracks. But being cracked is not broken. It's the reason we go to antique stores to retrieve beautiful things. It's because we appreciate what age does to things. You know, and all kinds of things. So the first thing I would say is that at a fundamental level, recognize that all human beings go through this. From a scientific perspective, the reason that there are two things you can do. We've been talking about a lot of cognitive strategies, which fall into cognitive behavior therapy, which has been helpful for a lot of different people. But another therapy that's on the horizon and doing really well is what's called acceptance commitment therapy. This starts with self-acceptance. It starts with recognizing that your life is a story. It's not a series of line judgments. That it's a story of happenings. And that to the extent that we can take these pithy judgments that we've made about ourselves and weave them into the whole story, we will start to experience our wholeness. And so acceptance commitment therapy is based in the fundamental assumption that human acceptance, self-acceptance, actually deactivates your amygdala. And when it deactivates your amygdala, it releases your thinking brain to do the kinds of things that you're doing right now. And so I think if I had to say one thing to anybody, I would say self-acceptance genuinely impacts the brain and genuinely decreases your anxiety so that you can use your vulnerability for good. Because if you think about it just deeply, you know, vulnerability gives you a certain kind of flexibility, openness, and an ability to be responsive to things outside of yourself that being stiff and sort of perfectionistic does not give you. You know, perfectionism is something that causes you to push on the brake every time. And so your body is metaphorically, your mind is metaphorically in a constant jerk back and forth. When you let go of that and you surrender to your vulnerability, what you will find is an ability to appreciate your cracks. And that's something that I think I would say to everybody, that it's both poetic and scientific to understand that human vulnerability is such a strength.
I love that. And you're exactly right. That was part of my own recovery to sort of fix some of my deep fractures at the time. My sling that helped things start repairing is that was one of the first steps is the help that I got is getting to the place of working. Like I had to break that perfectionism tendency and always, you know, the control of perfectionism and just that constant inner drive to that was stressful versus moving to the place like, no, I'm completely 100% okay just how I am. And reaching that place was the first step to move, was the first step to the work. So I didn't have a label for it, but that's exactly the work that I started with. As I had to learn to love myself exactly the way I am. And the accomplishment wasn't going to make me better in that, you know, that's not what was going to make me okay, or the next award or the next, you know, success story or the next nice thing somebody said to me. I just exactly all the cracks, everything, like you said, appreciate my cracks, right?
Yeah.
It was the first step of the healing. And then it's then getting there for myself, my own story is it's allowed me to live pretty much stress-free regardless of all the stuff that goes on. I mean, maybe that state of eustress you're talking about. Like there is stress, there's some tension and there's some tightrope walking, but there's an art and a joy to that. And I'm not afraid to fall off anymore.
Right. Absolutely. I think once you learn to let go of the past, it's a completely different experience. I actually had this experience. I was with my physical trainer this week and we were doing sagittal jumping where you stand on 2 feet and then jump two, you know, big squares on the floor ahead. And he kept on saying to me, and he landed, when he demonstrated, he landed so softly. And I said to him, how are you landing softly? And he told me, you know, bend your knees, stick the landing, and then let your feet sort of land on your heels gently and then bring the front of your feet forward. But when I got it right, I had a complete mind, my mind changed. And I said, wow, that was ridiculous. Like, what just happened? I felt it was so vulnerable. I felt actually afraid of being in the air. And he was like, yeah, it's because you let the floor go mentally. Because before that, I was still holding onto the floor that I was leaping from. But when you let that go and you learn to let go and you recognize that leaving your past behind makes you feel insecure, but you really have to leave it behind in certain respects in order to meet a different future.
And that's all part of the circa, is part of the letting go of that control piece.
That's
well, right. Srini, this has been amazing. You're amazing. Thank you. One final question before we complete. Well, two questions, I guess. Number one is part of what I really work to do here at Wealthy Wealthy is myth bust, is that there's so much conventional wisdom out there that's just now been proven to be absolutely false. And but we believe it to be true. So our behaviors follow those beliefs. And so we're actually in maybe action thinking we're doing the right thing, but it's not serving us or just thwarting our intentions or just producing negativity or bad things in our life. So with your latest study, you're sort of on the edge of neuroscience and psychology, positive psychology and executive coaching, everything that you do. What's a myth out there that you sort of bump up against all the time? And would you do a little myth busting for me?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot. I'll mention two brief ones. The one is when people often feel they've got to choose between possibility and reality, as if possibility is some kind of fake state and reality is the real thing. We now know that placebo, which is when you give somebody a sugar pill that actually has no active effects, apparently. If you look in the brain, placebo actually causes the release of opioids. So it causes some kind of relief when you're taking it. And there are a lot of other brain studies to show that simply believing does release your brain to a more stressless state. And even if it's temporary, in the throes of life and the things that life sort of gives you, if you can introduce some possibility thinking into your day, simply saying, even without any necessary emotion, this is possible, I'm going to do it, I'm going to figure out how later, it actually does change your brain. So possibility is reality. And I think the myth is people think that possibility is not reality when in fact it is real. The second thing I think I'd say is that a lot of times people feel they've got to tell themselves what not to do. Like, you know, do not spend on that. Do not do this. And what studies show is that there's a phenomenon called ironic process theory that tells us that under stress, when you tell your brain not to do something, it does the exact opposite. So it's like you're at a party and you're carrying some red wine. You're thinking, I should not drop the wine on the couch. The next thing you know, the wine's all over the couch. Well, the reason that that happens is that your brain gets tripped up. All the resources are taken up by the stress. And instead of helping you prevent dropping that wine, it actually doesn't hear the knot and the wine's all over the place. It gets primed by it. So Daniel Wegner, who studied this phenomenon, often would recommend that you frame your goals in terms of what you want to do rather than what you don't want to do, so that if you're under stress, your brain is able to follow that. So the idea of I've got to somehow prevent myself from doing things is a myth. I think what's much more effective is to promote or allow yourself and frame the things, is to allow yourself to do the things you want to do and frame things in the positive. And so sometimes people think that that's just, you know, nonsense to frame in the positive, but the reality is that it actually helps your brain under stress.
Thank you. So one final question. How do people reach you, find you, reach you, study your work?
So a couple different ways. I'm actually in the process of rebranding right now, but my websites are drsreenipillai.com. And you know, I can give you the details for your site so people can reach me if they're interested.
Yes, we'll put a link to your site in our show notes.
Awesome. And I have a Facebook page, which is Srini Pillai MD, and I can direct people from there to, you know, a whole lot of different things. And also,
and I do recommend that. I love your videos on your Facebook page. You're always uploading lots of really helpful, actionable content.
Cool. Thank you. Yeah, I'd love to have more people, love to help more people. And also just, I think people also teach each other. And to the extent that I can encourage people who activate their genius to share their genius with other people, I feel like a lot of times I'm a conduit for that rather than a producer of that. So I would love to be able to do that.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you. And we might have to come back for a second interview and tackle some other fun topics of conversation.
That would be awesome. Thanks so much, Christina.
Thank you.
I told you Srini was amazing. If you want to learn more about Srini, his books, coaching, etc., be sure to check out the show notes at wealthywealthy.life. We have all the links to all of his good stuff there for you. And before I close, I'd like to give a couple of shout outs. Shout out to RSM for the really wonderful review, saying these are some of the most interesting and real conversations I've heard on a podcast. And thank you so much. That's my goal, to make it real and to make it interesting. And to the lover of health and money, she says, or he says, I love this podcast. Christina interviews leading unconventional thinkers and practitioners in the realms of money, wealth, and health wealth. Only listen if you wish to hear perspective that is on the edge and totally outside of the norm. So thank you to the lover of health and money. Up next is Mark Goldston, Dr. Mark Goldston, another psychiatrist MD and another famous author. The unique thing about Mark is that he is a former FBI and hostage negotiator, and he shares with all of us how to use some of his famous techniques to apply to our lives in order to have better relationships, to be able to listen better, to be able to be more engaged and be in more fulfilling relationships and conversations. So you don't want to miss it. Keep listening. Thanks so much.